If you enjoy listening to adventure stories, then you should visit thedihedral.com. You will find stories from other members of the community and read about climbing, life, and the outdoors. Follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Let's connect and climb on!
Climb on!
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Dihedral Podcast. This is Carrot, and today we have a very special guest, actually someone who's joined us before a couple of months ago. He may not be live with us, but I'm going to do my best to interpret him. I'm talking about Plato, who we got to talk a little bit about when we read his apology, which was The Trial of Socrates. And if you listened to that show, which hopefully you did, you might remember Socrates was put on trial essentially for doing philosophy and asking questions, and people wanted him to stop, and he refused. And there's a very famous line from the Apology where I think this idea is that if Socrates will just stop doing philosophy, he could probably get off, but he won't. He's like, I'm not going to stop asking questions. And so the quote is, the unexamined life is not worth living. And they said, fine, we'll kill you. And then they sentenced him to death and they killed him. But after they killed him, his very famous student Plato continued to write and talk and do philosophy and did a lot of great things, including opening the first school called the Academy, a place where people were allowed to ask questions without fearing death. But Plato's great work, I mean, what a lot of people would consider, I would say, a masterpiece, some people might say the masterpiece, is The Republic, which is 10 books long. It's great in terms of its quantity and it's great in terms of its quality. And I recommend everybody read it. The books are actually really short. They're more like chapters. But I thought today would be really cool to go over one of my favorite parts of The Republic, which is book 7. And book 7 talks about a very famous allegory that Plato wrote called the Allegory of the Cave. And so the reason I wanted to talk about this today is because it's a piece that I've wanted to write ever since we started the Dihedral. I don't know how long ago, 8, 10 years ago. I've written, me and the entire team have written hundreds and hundreds of pieces. But in the very beginning, I wanted to write a piece on the Allegory of the Cave because Plato talks about this climbing. It's kind of like spelunking, but it is climbing. It's really relevant and it definitely hits on something that's important to me, which is philosophy. But I haven't been able to put the pieces together. Every time I sit down to write it, I'm just like, I can't do this better than Plato. And so then I just don't do it. And I hope that one day I can come up with something that really promotes Plato's allegory of the cave in a tone that's really suitable for rock climbers and rock climbing. But up to this point, I haven't been able to. So that brings me to today's topic. Rather than just me write about Plato's allegory of the cave, I thought it'd be fun to just go over the allegory of the cave. Plato wrote it. He did a great job. I can't improve on it. But one day, again, like I'll try. I'll definitely make it worse. But now, I thought this was a perfect forum to actually explore the allegory with you. It's just a few pages long, and I think it's a really good story. And I'm going to be here just to try to break down some of the meaning, some of the allegory within the story itself. And hopefully you guys are willing to stick around for the ride. So before I start, let me just say that I always tell students, really, I think every semester I tell every class that if you live your entire life without reading Plato's Republic, then you've wasted your life. You have to read it. Again, this is something I say all the time, but I don't necessarily mean it. I think you can live a valuable life without reading The Republic, but I think it adds value to any life if you do read The Republic. So it's online, totally open source, free, and accessible to everybody. So yeah, feel free to check it out. If you need a link, just hit me up on one of our social media platforms. And if it's something that you ever want to talk about, again, I'm always here for you. So anyway, without further ado, let me get into the beginning of Book 7 of The Republic. This is Socrates talking to his buddy, Glaucon. So let me just, I'll read a little and then I'll break down what I think is pertinent. So if you're just like, I don't know exactly what you're saying, hold on a second and I'm going to unpack some of the details from Plato. So here we go. It starts off as follows. Next said I, compare our nature and respect of education and its lack to such an experience as this. This is Socrates talking. This is Carrot talking from Plato writing about Socrates talking. But this is essentially Socrates talking. He says, picture men dwelling in a sort of subterranean cavern with a long entrance open to the light on its entire width. Conceive them as having their legs and necks fettered from childhood so that they remain in the same spot, able to look forward only and prevented by the fetters from turning their heads. Picture further the light from a fire burning higher up and at a distance behind them. And between the fire and the prisoners and above them, a road along which a low wall has been built, as exhibitors of puppet shows have partitions before the men themselves, above which they show puppets. And I know that's a lot. So let me give you what might be an easier visual. Let's go inside a cave. Down inside of a cave, there's a long, bumpy roadway that gets us down there. And as we get into the cave, there's a wall. And looking directly at that wall are what we're going to call these perpetual prisoners. They've lived in front of this wall for their entire lives. Now, they can't move. They can't stand up. They can't, move their arms. They're just all chained up. They can't look up. They can't look down. All they can do is look directly in front of them. And in front of them is a wall. Now, behind these prisoners, a place that they wouldn't understand because they've never looked behind them is another group. There's like a partition, like he says, like in a puppet show, you know how people hold their hands over this partition? It looks like the puppets are talking. So there's this partition, and behind the partition is a fire. And so anytime people behind the partition hold something up, it blocks the light of the fire and creates a shadow on the wall that these perpetual prisoners have been looking at for their entire lives. So they look at the wall, and they, as we'll see, are going to see shadows on the wall that are created by people behind them. And so Glaucon just says, oh, all that I see. I maybe need to work on my voices for Glaucon and Socrates, but we'll see how that goes. So Glaucon just says, yeah, all that I see. So Socrates continues, see also then merry men carrying past the wall implements of all kinds that rise above the wall in human images and shapes of animals as well, wrought in stone and wood and every material. Some of these bears presumably speaking and others silent. A strange image you speak of, says Glaucon, and strange prisoners. Like to us, I said, again Socrates talking, for to begin with, tell me, do you think that these men would have seen anything of themselves or of one another, except the shadows cast from the fire of the wall of the cave that fronted them? And so he asked Glaucon this question, do you think these guys would have ever seen one another? And Glaucon responds, of course not. Remember, they can't move their neck. They can't look up, down. They can't look left, right. They can't even move their hands. They're chained up, looking forward only. So all they would have seen their entire lives are the shadows that were cast on the wall from the fire behind them, a fire that they don't even know exists. And Glaucon responds, much like I just did, how could they? How could they see one another? If they were compelled to hold their heads unmoved through life. And again, would not the same be true of the objects carried past them? Surely. If then they were able to talk to one another, do you not think that they would suppose that in naming the things that they saw, they were naming passing objects? And this is a really important question. So again, we have these people behind this wall who are holding up these puppets. Essentially, they're carvings of different animals. And so every time they hold up a carving of an animal, it creates a shadow that is cast on the wall in front of the prisoners. And so not only do they hold up an animal, they'll also make a noise that goes along with that animal, and they'll make it consistent. So every time they hold up that animal, it'll be the same noise. So they might hold up something that's the shape of a cow, and they make it seem like the shadow's moving across the wall. And so they might be like, moo, 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 the perfect imitation of a cow. And then maybe a frog, ribbit, 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 and a dog, fruff, and maybe a kitten, then it's just like, mew. That is, they have these different animals and they make these different noises. Okay, so continuing on with the story, if their prison had an echo from the wall opposite them, when one of the passers-by uttered a sound, do you think that they would suppose anything else than the passing shadow to be the speaker? So now there's this question to Glaucon. Look, they see these shadows. Do you think that the prisoners would believe that somebody behind them is making shadows? Or do you think that they would think that the shadow of the cow is the thing saying moo, 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 or the shadow of the kitten is the thing saying mew, 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 or whatever? And so Glaucon's like, by Zeus, maybe more excited. By Zeus, I do not, says Glaucon. Back to Socrates. Then in every way, such prisoners would deem reality to be nothing else than the shadows of the artificial objects. And so that's what reality would be to them. they wouldn't think that there's a puppet behind them. They would think that the shadow is a thing crawling across the wall. And every time they hear moo or ribbit or woof woof, they would think that the shadow is the talker. Again, they don't know that it behind them exists. And because of the echo in the cave, the sound would look like it's not only look, but also sound like it's coming from the shadows themselves. So again, just to repeat that, he says, in every way, such prisoners would deem reality to be nothing else than the shadows of the artificial objects. That's what they would think reality was. And Glaucon agrees. He says, quite inevitably. Again, my Glaucon voice isn't great, but I'm doing my best. So back to Socrates. He says, consider then, what would be the manner of release and healing from these bonds and this folly if in the course of nature, something of this sort should happen to them? When one of them was freed from his fetters, right, his chains, and compelled to stand up suddenly and turn his head around and walk and to lift up his eyes to the light, and in doing all this felt pain because of the dazzle and the glitter of the light, he was unable to discern the objects whose shadows he formerly saw. What do you suppose would be his answer if someone told him that what he had seen before was all a cheat and an illusion, but that now being near to reality and turned toward more real things, he saw more truly? And if also one should point out to him each of the passing objects and constrain him by questions to say what it is, do you think that he would be at a loss and that he would regard what he formerly saw as more real than the things pointed out to him now? So let me break this down for you. Again, there's kind of a lot going on. We're going to go up to one of these perpetual prisoners, presumably while they're all asleep, and then we're just going to free this person. Let's just call him, I don't know, Alex Honnold or something like that. So we go up to Alex Honnold and we free Alex Honnold. Now, Socrates is pointing out the pain that Alex would feel. He talks about looking at the light. Imagine you've never looked directly at any light, whatever. The amount of pain that you would feel in your eyes is probably unimaginable. All of us can relate to, I don't know, camping or something like this, and somebody coming up to our tent and into our tent with their headlamp on, it kind of hurts when we look at it. Or if you are sleeping and somebody just comes into your bedroom and turns the lights on, it's not a pleasurable feeling or experience. Imagine you've never seen light and you're forced to look at light for the first time. Not only that, if you've ever sat with your legs crossed for a very long time and you're forced to stand up suddenly, there's pain in your legs. And again, imagine you've never moved your legs. The pain that you would experience in just standing up would probably be unimaginable. And so the question that's posed to Glaucon is this. It's something along the lines of, if we questioned our released prisoner, Alex Honnold, and said, look, everything that you saw before was a cheat, and now you're seeing what things really are. They're just these carvings or these puppets or things like that. And so he asked this question, do you think that he would turn away and flee and look at what he saw, the shadows, as more real? To which Glaucon says, far more real. And I think that's right. I imagine our prisoner, Alex Honnold, would be like, this is a nightmare. Like, I don't know what's happening. I don't understand any of this, but reality is back in this thing that I've known my entire life. And so, continuing on, if he were compelled to look at the light itself, would not that pain his eyes? And would he not turn away and flee to those things which he is able to discern and regard them as in very deed more clear and exact than the objects pointed out to him now? And so again, we talk more about this pain. Again, he has to look at the light. It's going to be painful. This is not an easy thing to do. And so time goes by. All right, eventually we're gonna show Alex Honnold. We'll hold up one of the puppets and we're like, Alex, look at the shadow that's created. And then we take down the puppet and the shadow goes away. And then we hold up the frog puppet, for example. And look, Alex, now the frog puppet is up on the wall. Alex, you try. And so Alex can lift up the puppet and take it down. And he would probably think, my goodness, you're right. My life was a lie. Like, I thought that was real, but these things are controlling it. These things are real. And so now we can say, all right, Alex, check this out. And we hold up one of the animals, the frog, for example, and we move it across the wall saying, ribbit, 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 ribbit. Holy crap, that was you. You're the ribbit voice. That's totally bananas. I just can't believe it. So Alex is going to be up there for a long time. He's going to learn the ins and outs of holding the puppets up, and that's eventually going to be kind of his job. He'll hold the puppets up and he'll move them along, and somebody else might say ribbit or moo or something like that. But Alex is going to find that there's improvement in his life. And here's why I think that's probably the case. as I just scratched the back of my ear. Imagine having an itch and you can't scratch it because you're chained up and you don't even know what it is you would scratch to begin with. Imagine being able to scratch an itch for the first time. The amount of pleasure that you would get from that would be so, I don't even know, I don't have the words. It would be a relief. And now, like, as I'm just talking about itching, my whole head's starting to itch. So I'm sorry for starting to scratch anything. But anyway, just that. I mean, your ability to flex, your ability to be by a warm fire rather than just being kind of like naked, looking at shadows for your entire life. And so there's a pretty large level of improvement just by this simple growth into this next section of holding puppets rather than looking at shadows as you're chained up. Okay, so continuing on with the story, back to Socrates. If, said I, someone should drag him by, I'm sorry, let me start over. And if, said I, someone should drag him thence by force up the ascent, which is rough and steep, and not let him go before he had drawn him out into the light of the sun, do you think that he would find it painful to be so hauled along and would chafe at it? And when he came out of the light, that his eyes would be filled with its beams, so that he would not be able to see even one of the things that we call real. So now we're going to take Alex Honnold, and we're going to drag him up this steep, rough ascent, and he's going to get cut and battered and bruised and beaten, and it's going to be an unimaginable level of pain. And then we just throw him out of the cave like he's never been in there. And so it's one thing to see a dim fire in a dark cave. That's not a great experience at first. You adapt. But now imagine that you're thrown directly into the sunlight for the first time. You would essentially be blind. You wouldn't be able to see any of the things that you and I can see on a day-to-day basis because the sun is so bright. It would be hurting your eyes. And so the question was, he would not be able to see even one of the things that we call real. And Glaucon responds, "Why, no, not immediately." And so Socrates continues, "Then there would be need for habituation, I take it, to enable him to see things higher up. And at first, he would most easily discern the shadows. And after that, the likenesses or reflections in water of men and other things, and later the things themselves. And from these, he would go on to contemplate the appearance in heavens and heaven itself more easily by night, looking at the light of the stars and the moon than by the day and the sun and the sun's light." So he's going to be out there for a while, and the sun's going to go down. And he's going to be like, "Oh, sweet Eleusis, this is spectacular." And now he's able to see things, right? He can look down and he can see his own shadow. He's familiar with shadows. He's lived his entire life in a cave, and he might see the shadow of a tree or the shadow of a cow. He can go up to, I don't know, a lake and see his actual reflection, be like, "Oh my, this is what I look like. This is really great." And so, again, there is going to be pain, but he's going to get used to it. And he's going to be out there for a while. So let me continue reading. "And so finally, I suppose that he would be able to look upon the sun itself and see its true nature, not by reflections in water or phantasms of it in an alien setting, but in and by itself in its own place." And so eventually he's going to get it. He's just going to be able to be outside in the sun, feeling its warmth, doing cool stuff, you know? And Socrates continues, "And at this point, he would infer and conclude that it is that, the sun, that provides the seasons and the courses of the year, and presides over all things in the visible region, and is in some sort the cause of all the things that he had seen." And so I don't know how long Alex Honnold is going to be out of the cave, but long enough to just become one of us, a person who's able to experience all the great things that people can experience. Alex Honnold will be able to fall in love and go rock climbing, can go swimming and climb trees and swing from branches and just lay in the grass and feel the warmth of the sun on his hair, on his face, on his body, things like that. Make friends and again experience all the great things that a person can experience. Now, I don't know how long it would take you to recognize that it's the sun that's responsible for the seasons or that it's responsible for all of life. But I think it might be generous to say that somebody with no education would maybe take 10 years or so to understand that. So at this point, let's say it's 15 years from the time that he was released from his initial bonds, 5 years behind the wall holding up puppets, and now another 10 years just living life, like enjoying life. And so now Socrates gets a little bit deeper in his questions. He says, "Well then, if Alex Honnold recalled to his mind his first habitation and what passed for wisdom there and his fellow bondsmen, do you think that he would count himself happy in the change and pity them? And Glaucon says he would indeed. And so, look, yeah, he went through pain. At first, he had to go through pain to get behind the wall, and then an immense amount of pain just to get out of the cave, something that's really, really tricky to do. But in the long run, the question is, do you think he would be happy that he went through all that suffering for this greater reward, this idea of being able to not only scratch an itch, but fall in love? Or scale the side of a cliff face, or go swimming, or any of the great things that you and I get to do on a regular basis. And so, yeah, Glaucon says he would be happy, and he would definitely pity the people who are still stuck in the cave. And so Socrates continues, and if there had been honors and commendations among them, which they bestowed on one another, and prizes for the man who is quickest to make out the shadows as they pass, and best able to remember their customary precedences, sequences, and coexistences, and so most successful in guessing what was to come, do you think that he would be very keen about such rewards, and that he would envy and emulate those who were honored by these prisoners and lorded it among them? Or that he would feel with Homer and greatly prefer, while living on earth, to be the serf of another, a landless man, and endure anything rather than opine with them and live that life? And so we can break this down very easily. Let's say we give Alex Honnold the option. Look, Alex Honnold, you can go back in the cave, we'll lock you up, and you're going to be very good at noticing what the shadows are. You'll be the best at noticing shadows. Or you can stay out here, and in this case, you're like a dirt bag without a van and without climbing gear. You have nothing, right? So in that sense, you can stay out here with nothing, a landless man without a penny to your name, or you can go back in the cave and be a great guesser. And so this is Glaucon's response, which I think is a pretty good response. Glaucon says, I think he would choose to endure anything rather than such a life. Essentially admitting that, look, the worst life that we could experience out here is still better than the best life in a cave. Because remember, once you've left the cave, the idea of going back to not even be able to scratch an itch is something that you probably couldn't comprehend and wouldn't want to comprehend. And so, yeah, maybe a dirtbag lifestyle in which you can't even have the opportunity to climb is still better than being imprisoned in a cave when you're essentially blind, right? Just because we can't do all the stuff that we want out here, there's still a lot of great things. Certain things as simple as just sitting in the sun and feeling its warmth, or stretching your arms, or going for a walk, or, you know, noticing a reflection or a shadow in a lake or a pond. Okay, so despite what Alex Honnold wants, we're going to change everything. We're just like, you're going back. And so Socrates says, consider this. If such a one should go down again and take his old place, would he not get his eyes full of darkness, thus suddenly coming out of the sunlight? So we're putting him back in the cave, whether he wants to or not. And now he won't be able to see the stuff that he formerly saw. He's been accustomed to the light. At first, he was sort of blind getting out of the cave, but now he's going to be blind going back into the cave. Okay, so yeah, just continuing. And if he should be required to contend with these perpetual prisoners in evaluating these shadows while his vision was still dim and before his eyes were accustomed to the dark, this time required for habituation would not be very short. Would he not provoke laughter? And would it not be said of him that he had returned from his journey aloft with his eyes ruined, and that it was not worthwhile even to attempt the ascent? And if it were possible to lay hands on and kill the man who tried to release them, would they not kill him? And that's the end of the allegory of the cave. So let me break down this last section, because there's kind of a lot going on. So we take Alex Honnold, we put him back in the cave, and he might try to explain it. You guys, you have a body, like there's a back of your head, and there's these things called eyes, and they're what allow you to see these shadows. But these shadows aren't real. They're created by these people behind you, and they're holding up puppets and making these noises. And I saw it. But even more, work really hard. You're going to get cut and bloodied and beat up. And you go out to this place with this thing that's called the sun, and it's so beautiful. And there's swimming and rock climbing and trees and falling in love. And try to explain any of that to somebody who has never experienced any of it. It's not going to go well. And so Socrates says, would they not laugh at him? You know, as he returned from his journey aloft with his eyes ruined, they're going to be like, I don't know what they did to you, but now you're literally an insane person. They wouldn't see him, of course. They would just hear him talking. You're literally an insane person talking nonsense, and you can't even see any of the things that that we can see. They blinded you. They destroyed your brain. Whatever they did to you, it was horrible. And no matter how much Alex Honnold doth protest, they're just not going to believe him because they can't understand it. And so now we get to the very end of the allegory of the cave. Plato writes, or Socrates says, and if it were possible to lay hands on and kill the man who tried to release them and lead them up, would they not kill him? So now let's say we go up to one of these other perpetual prisoners and we're just like, hey, I don't know, Frankie, we're going to do to you what we did to Alex Honnold. Frankie's going to be like, nope, you're not. And now I'm going to kill you. Now, of course, it's an allegory. So they probably couldn't kill them. They probably don't even know how to use their hands, but they would sure want to kill the person who tried to release them. So, allegory of the cave. This is a great story. Maybe without a little background, it's not great, but it's doing a lot. Plato is really intentional with what he writes. And so I want to break down some of the allegorical things behind the story itself. And so essentially what he's saying, what Plato is saying, is that you and I are the ones inside the cave, right? We're the ones looking at the shadows thinking it's real. And it's very comfy down in that cave if we don't know anything different. And so if we work a little bit, we can get beyond what's right in front of us. And I think Plato thinks most people do. Most people get to that wall with the petition and they can kind of hold up the frog and the cow and the kitten and things like that. It takes a little bit of work to get there. And it's a better life. And most people are done. Like, that's it. They get to this certain point, like, yep, I'm good. I don't ever need to do anything else. So we get to a particular point in our lives and there's no more growth. But what Socrates is saying here, but that's not the end. There's so much more beyond that. You got to push yourself and it's not easy. It's hard and you're going to get battered and bloodied and beat up. And it's going to be very, very painful. And I think there is something about rock climbing that goes along with this. When we get better at rock climbing, it hurts. Our hands are beat up. Our legs are beat up. We're always injured. But if we continue to work at it, we do see progress. We continue to climb out of the cave. But I think education is another thing that goes along with this. There's these horrible statistics that when people graduate college, less than 50% will ever read a book ever again. It's weird to think that you graduate high school, you graduate college, and you're done. You don't need to grow anymore. And so we push ourselves. And if we continue to push ourselves, we continue to get better. And that's what it is to get out of the cave. And so once we get to these points where we've gone through the suffering, we're able to do things, we're able to see things that we couldn't have imagined as we were looking at the cave. And eventually we can get to a place in our lives where we've grown and we've learned that we wouldn't exchange that for anything in the world. We're not going back into the cave once we were able to sort of peek the light. And so anyway, there's a lot more representation, all the shadows, the sun, all these things represent things according to Plato's metaphysics, which is, again, something I'm more than happy to talk about, but I don't want to overstay my welcome on this. The point is, people get trapped looking at their cell phones, this little blue screen. The average person looks at their cell phone between 3 and 4 hours a day now. It's just bananas. And we look at that as if that's reality. No, that's not reality. Screens aren't reality. Shadows aren't reality. It takes work to peel ourselves away from that stuff because that stuff is easy. But in doing that work, we go to the crag, we go to the gym, we meet people, we have interactions. And while climbing is great, those interactions are absolutely priceless. And so the difference between looking at a climber on YouTube or on Instagram or TikTok and actually going out to the crag and meeting people and climbing walls and pushing yourselves, that's what Plato is talking here. Again, probably more about education, but I do see an overlap with rock climbing as well. And so I want to go back now to the last point. He says, if it were possible to lay hands on and kill the man who tried to release them, would they not kill him? Plato in this case is writing about something very specific. What he's talking about is Socrates. And so Socrates was trying to wake people up, right? When he's having these conversations, going back to the apology, the last conversation we had about Plato a couple of months ago, when he's saying, hey, look, I know you think you know this definition, or you think you know this, the meaning of this term, but you don't. Like, you're kind of stuck. You haven't thought about it much. And I'm not saying that I know either, but we should talk about it. We could communicate and we can actually learn and grow together. We can ascend from this cave. And so Socrates did that. He tried to teach people that there's a better life of asking questions, of growing, of learning. And what did they do to Socrates? They killed him. So Plato's not just making this stuff up, right? A lot of people would rather kill than admit that they can be wrong or admit that what they believe is wrong. Nobody wants to admit that the life that they live and the world they see could possibly be incorrect. And in some people, in some people, or sometimes they're willing to kill to protect that ignorance. It's bananas. But I can almost guarantee if any of us have a role model throughout the history of mankind, I mean, a major figure out in the world, there's a good chance that that person is a role model because they were killed for what they believed or what they stood up for. Socrates is a great example. Martin Luther King is another great example. You think of somebody like Martin Luther King, and he's just like, hey, everybody, I have an idea. Why don't we not be assholes to one another? And people are like, are you kidding me? Don't tell me what to do. I'd rather kill you. And they killed him, and it happens again and again. So this is where I think the Republic, going back to what I say to my students, that you should read the Republic. This is why I think it's very, very important. On the very first line of the Republic, again, it's 10 books long. Socrates states, and remember, Plato writes this. So Plato writes, I went down yesterday to the Piraeus with Glaucon. Now, in the ancient world, if you read, I went down yesterday to the Piraeus with Glaucon, it's already informing you that this is weird. There's no going down to the Piraeus. I remember being in grad school and busting out the maps and having fun with this. It's elevated. It's north. You don't go down to the Piraeus. If anything, you go up to the Piraeus. And so this is kind of Plato calling the reader out to be like, this is a little bit off, so pay attention. Essentially, when he says, I went down yesterday to the Piraeus with Glaucon, he's holding the Republic. This is Plato now. He's holding the Republic and saying, look, I'm gonna do what Socrates did. I'm gonna give you a roadmap to get out of this cave, to grow, to learn, to get better. But in this case, you don't kill me, because now it's just an allegory. It's just a story. And so I really love the Republic. I really love talking about the Republic. And I think the allegory of the cave is brilliant. And so let me just say one thing, and then we'll cut out of here. We'll climb out of the cave and go for a climb or something like that. So he talks about the sun a little bit, right? It's the reason for the seasons. It provides life and everything like that. Plato had this notion of this thing called the good. In his metaphysics. And so about the good, he says, I can't really tell you what it is. And even if I did, you wouldn't understand. It's something that each of us have to get to on our own. But whatever the good is, it's the thing that gives meaning to all of our lives. And so you could interpret that however you want to. You could use the good to represent whatever you want it to represent, but ultimately it's a thing that you have to arrive at your on your own. And of course we do that raising questions, by listening to interesting things, by reading interesting books, and hopefully there's some growth along the way. So that's it. I want to thank you, as always, for listening to me talk, especially today, about one of my favorite philosophers. Obviously, I want to thank Plato for joining us on another podcast, and I look forward to talking to you guys very soon. All right, have a great day.